Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2018. Lecture 14, delivered on March 5, 2018. The title of this lecture is Review for Exam 1.
Today, review for Exam 1. Exam 1 is four questions. The format is different from what I have done before because exams tend to get onto the internet, and I don't want to test the internet, and I don't want to test groupthink. I'm testing you individually. Those four questions are written answers, no more than two sentences each. There's a grading rubric for writing on these exams in your resources tab on ReggieNet. I think I've got it going live now. I'll have to check later to make sure that it actually is visible to you. But make sure you read through that. Complete sentences, no misspellings, no abbreviations. Don't text me anything. This is following the strong advice of corporate officials who said that they don't want texting language, they want complete sentences. But you have two sentences. Don't spill over because you'll lose points for a third sentence. Or if you're going trying to do run-on sentences, you should be able to answer efficiently in two sentences. They can be compound sentences, of course. Matter of fact, they should be. But important for you to cut out the nonsense and just get down to the answer. The reason for this is that in the real life of a workplace, you're not going to be writing reports and essays if a boss asks you for an answer. Those bosses are going to expect you to give them, in a very short amount of time, what they want to know. And this is helping you get to the point where you can do that. Show your knowledge without going into a long-winded exercise. Read that rubric because you will be held to its standards for spelling, grammar, punctuation, and all of that. It should take you about 20 to 25 minutes to answer the questions, and that means that you will have ample time to go back and review your answers. If you're leaving here in 10 minutes, as some students do, guarantee you, you're probably going to lose considerable points just because you can't edit your own answers. Now, basics of the exam. As I said, four questions. Now, two of those questions are going to be based on a printout of a screen, of a stock screen. Those of you who have been here regularly should have no problem with reading the information. And I'll give you some insights into what I'm looking for. Two different questions regarding the same stock screen. It'll be a printout of a screen from last Friday. Since it takes a few days to print the exams, I couldn't do it closer to real time. Now I'm going to put one up here, and we'll talk about it and what my expectations are on those two questions. And in the meantime, also, a third question will be a screen that shows you bonds, actual corporate bonds. And I'll get to that one in just a little bit here. But three of the four questions are challenging you to look at numbers and give answers based upon those numbers that you see. There is no math in this exam. As a matter of fact, if you try to do a calculation, you're definitely not understanding the question. And you do not give me a formula on this exam. I don't want to see formulas either. You're past that. You do more than enough math and formulas and calculators in the assessments online. And this is where you show me that you understand what you've been doing. Now, I'm going to just pull one up at random here, some company, and we'll talk about what my expectations, some of what they could be. Now, obviously, I'm not going to tell you the exact questions that I'll ask. Oops. Let's try Nordstrom. It's a company in... Serious? Is there some reason this sucks? Oh. Nordstrom, JWN. I couldn't remember. I knew it had a weird trading symbol for the company. Okay, well, rough day. Now, I could ask you a question that has to do with the market cap. We'll try something here. Ma'am, interpret this company's market cap. <That's>, you're like, I got nothing. Okay, now, if you say, well, the market cap is the price per share times the number of shares outstanding, that's very good. You'll lose all the points. It's not what I'm looking for. Even though that's correct, that's not an interpretation. The market cap, see if I got anyone who wants to take a stab. You want to take a stab? Interpret this company's market cap. Can you do that? You're confused. Why are you confused?
I'm not sure what the number represents.
You don't know. Okay, let's try this. Market cap. What does market cap mean? The formula is price per share times the number of shares outstanding. So this represents the value, the market's assessment of the value of the company. Okay? This represents the market's assessment of the value of, I should say, the equity of the company. What value do the shareholders have according to the market? Remember I showed you the book value and the market value? The book value I brought from the SEC's Edgar statements and its financial statements, and it is almost never even close to the market cap. They're very different numbers. The book value, total shareholders' equity, is an accounting number. It has no meaning to the market itself. The market says that the equity, the shareholders have a value in this company of $8.667 billion. That's the market's assessment of the value of the equity, the total value of the equity in the company. That's what the market cap, that's what I would expect you to be able to tell me. Show me that you understand the market cap. And that would go back to the lectures 2, 3, and 4, where I showed you market caps and book values. And in subsequent lectures, when I showed screens, I almost always mentioned the market cap again and explained it. So if you haven't got it in your notes, go back to my podcast. They sit there waiting for you. They're lonely. They want to have people hear them. Okay. That's one thing that I could ask you. Show me that you understand that you can't just regurgitate a number or calculate a number, but that you understand the number. Now, another approach that I might be take, and this one would be, okay, ma'am, is this company stock risky or not risky, relatively speaking? Help me out here. It is not risky. You almost got it. You said risky. It is not risky. That's one word away from it. Okay. Let's try this. Okay. Now, sir, it's not risky. Explain. There are actually two different numbers that measure risk here. And they might actually not tell you the same story. And I'll ask you, is there something you would like to say beyond just So tell me, why is this not a risky stock? What do you see that tells you this is a low-risk stock?
First thing is that the beta is under 1.
Outstanding.
Less volatile than the market itself.
And here's where it's important to say, this stock is a relatively non-risky investment in a well-diversified portfolio. Stocks are wildly risky. Any stock is wildly risky if you hold it naked. But in a well-diversified portfolio, this is particularly well-behaved because the beta is considerably less than 1. That's good. Now, there's another measure of risk that you always want to just have a quick look at. In this case, do you remember what that one is? No, no. It's the price-earnings ratio, P/E ratio. Remember I told you there was a number, it used to be the numbers can be higher these days and still indicate low risk. Back before the 1990s, I mean, P/E ratios above a certain amount were really amazing. Do you remember what that number was? I threw it out a couple of times, but I didn't really make a big thing about it. But you should consider there's a pivot. A P/E ratio above a certain number indicates considerably more risk than a P/E ratio well below a certain number. Do you remember the number that I threw out to keep an eye on? What was it?
15.
No, it's 30. 15 was scary back in my time. Now 30. I think you remember that 15. 30, I mean, a P/E ratio above 30 does indicate a secondarily risk. P/E ratios below 30, well, that's not telling me that there's a lot of risk. And in this case, the beta is being confirmed by the P/E ratio. They're both not terrible. They're not high. But the beta of 0.57 indicates that in a well-diversified portfolio, this is a relatively safe investment. And be sure that you say, in a well-diversified portfolio, every stock is risky if you buy it on its own. But all stocks have a different behavior when you put them into a well-diversified portfolio. When you're alone in your apartment, you're an animal. You're just doing ridiculous things. You're pretending you're a ninja, doing slow motion, things like that. And then there's that thing you try to do with Thor thing where you try to pull a hammer to yourself, and when it doesn't, you go over and grab it. Ha ha, me, Thor. Okay, but when you're in public, when you're with a bunch of other people, everyone thinks you're mild-mannered. Clark Kent in public, Superman in private. That's the thing with all stocks. You have to tell, and this is something you carry beyond this course. You're going to have enough knowledge that you can say things about stocks to other people. Don't be an investment advisor, for God's sake, without a lot more courses. But you can say, I can't talk about that stock on its own, but in a well-diversified portfolio, this stock is relatively safe. Yeah, go. Then, okay, no, always go with beta to begin with. However, and matter of fact, let me pull up another one here real quick. I'm trying to think of one where there'd be a distinction. I know many, but thinking of one right off the top of my head. Oh, let me try Delta Airlines. They were in the news. I wanted to bring them up anyway. Actually, this one, tell me, what do you see about the beta of this? Comment on the risk according to beta.
The beta is relatively close to 1, so in a well-diversified portfolio, it would generally be considered.
Of of average risk, of market risk. I know this one's one that, what do you say here? This is in the right in the middle zone. This is a moderate risk investment in a well-diversified portfolio. However, you notice that PE ratio is quite low. And that would be something that I would ask you on the exam. Are your measures consistent? Does one indicate something other than what the other one does? In this case, Delta Airline, interestingly enough, its beta, I mean, it's not an insanely risky investment. It's a market risk investment in a well-diversified portfolio. But the PE ratio is kind of pointing to something that's a little bit safer than a market risk investment, interestingly, in this case. And you would note that in your answer. Because if you have too much absolute when you're answering questions, sometimes that's a sign that you really aren't looking at all of the different possibilities and factors. A quick note about Delta, by the way. They were in the news last week, it was. They were one of the companies that announced that it was breaking off its discounts for the National Rifle Association members. And as retaliation, the state of Georgia legislature pulled a $40 million tax break for Delta Airlines to build a hub at the Atlanta airport. Well, you heard these moaners say, well, that's going to really hurt Delta, blah, cry, cry. Okay, look at the 1 month. No, it didn't. Don't believe talking heads. Think for yourself. I mean, right away, there were cities lining up. We'll get you a tax break, Delta. I mean, that's how markets work. Ideology really doesn't work too well. Now, Delta obviously, notice, by the way, that it's a pretty crazy stock. It does have its volatility, but, I mean, it took a little dip, and then, oh, that's a bargain, and the bargain hunters came in and snatched that stock right back up because it did not, that news, that thing didn't really create any fundamental change in the company itself and in its ability to generate cash flows. And that's all we care about. We don't care about the politics, right or left wing. All we care about is can the company make money and get some of that down to the bottom line for the shareholders. Okay? Yeah.
I have a question just about the PE ratio again. So basically, PE ratio above 30 is considerably more risky, but why is that number 30?
Well, because I pulled that out of my backside. Okay, here's the thing. The PE ratio, as I had explained before, price earnings ratio simply says how many dollars is a prospective stock investor willing to pay for future earnings from a dollar of earnings now. In other words, the company makes a dollar, the PE ratio says how many dollars the market thinks that dollar is going to earn for the shareholders in the future. So the more dollars the market thinks it's going to earn in the future, the more likely they're going to be wrong, the more optimistic they are. So when I see a PE ratio of like 70, or what was the company was, I can't remember what it was, a 200, they think that a single dollar that belongs to the shareholders from the last period is going to create 200 more dollars for the shareholders in the future as a present value. Now that's just pie in the sky. That's scary speculation. In other words, the price per share is incredibly high relative to the current earnings of the company, meaning they think this company is going to gather a lot of money. Glad you asked that, though. Now, let me go on here. There's another approach that I can take is this. We're back to Nordstrom now. Now, this looks like a very tough problem, but the first part of it is almost a joke. Ma'am, can you tell me this company's dividend policy?
Yeah,
you're going too far. All you have to say is this company pays a dividend, and it's a relatively high dividend based on the price. That's their dividend. They pay dividends, as opposed to a company that does not pay dividends. Now, here comes the part that you have to be able to answer. It's a little more of a challenge to you. Okay, sir, with respect to dividends, this company's dividend policy is to pay dividends. I mean, you can get more detailed, but okay, what does that mean about the company's relative growth of stock price in the future?
It's a healthy growth.
Except that if it doesn't pay a dividend, that means that it's putting all of the earnings that it has for the shareholders back into the company, which means that in a company that doesn't have dividends, you would anticipate, you would expect that the company should grow faster than a company of the same character that does pay a dividend. And so a company that grows faster would have what happened to its stock price. You would expect that a company that pays a dividend, that does not pay a dividend, to have a higher growth rate of stock price than a company that pays a dividend. That's no guarantee. Everything, for God's sake, make sure that you talk expectations. Don't say anything certain about the future. The only things that we can say that are certain about the future, okay, and I'm going to personalize this. I can say, I will die, okay? That is a guarantee, but everything else is an expectation. I expect to have 2 Chick-fil-A sandwiches with extra pickles tonight. Will I have those? I don't know. You're probably right. I got to check how much money I have in my pocket. It might be pretty sad. It might just be another can of Spam at Schnucks. But that's not bad. Fried up, you know, with the crispy edges and that one that has the cheese. Okay. Anyway. You're looking a little green as I talk about that. Okay. Where the hell was... Oh, okay. Talk to me about the dividend and what this says about the company. You see, because the dividend is more guaranteed money right now. I buy this stock, I'm going to get a check. At least you hope, unless they change the dividend policy. But remember what I said, companies really don't like to change their dividend policy. So I know that because this company pays a dividend, I am going to get this money in the here and now, an almost certain cash flow. But that also means that the growth of the stock price, my capital gain, becomes more speculative because some of that money that could have caused the company to grow and therefore the stock price to rise is not going to do that because they gave it back to me as an owner. I want you to be able to talk to me about things like that. Show me that you understand that. Again, don't go into an essay. You got 2 sentences to impress me. Do so. Let me take it forward here. I'll do one more with you. Yeah, go ahead. Yes. Okay. Have you ever eaten, you know, like Oscar Mayer wieners, or you know, the like what's Dinner Bell? Okay. Have you ever eaten Spam? You haven't? Okay, I was in Indonesia. I was served a cup of coffee. I didn't pay for it. The coffee was $300 for this small cup of it. I said, this is incredible coffee. I've never had anything like this before. But then they told me how it was made. There are these wild cats who eat the coffee beans, and then they harvest after the cats have gotten rid of them. Then they roast it. Kid you not. You see, that's one of the things where I am so very sorry I asked, how is this coffee made? Okay? It's like a cheese I had in Catalonia. Are any of you familiar with that cheese? It is so delicious. And it's so gross that the rest of the European Union has forbidden Catalonia from exporting it. Beta, the calculation of it, I will actually show you. It's based upon forward volatility of the stock relative to the market portfolio. It essentially involves the covariance of the stock's price up and down with the market's price up and down, seeing how much of it is connected together and how much of it is not connected. That's how beta is calculated. There are new ways, and the funniest thing is that a survey was taken a few years ago. Companies that use beta versus other more primitive methods for assessing risk. And it's odd because you would think that with all of the education we have and all of the MBA programs and undergrad programs, almost all companies would be using the capital asset pricing model approach, in other words, the beta approach. Oddly, only about 45% of the companies are using this method. Others are using methods that are completely repudiated. They're like myths, but they're still using them. Like one called payback method, where you just see, you pick a number of years, this project has to pay itself back in 4 years. So they just project the revenues and say, all right, in what year have you accumulated so much revenue that it pays back what it costs? Completely invalid method, it's still used. And there are other ones too. Others are just complete gut. Well, we just look at it and decide whether we want to do it or not. Okay, now, let me pull one more screen up for you. No, that's not what I wanted. FedEx. And I'm going to do this just one more time to make sure that you understand. Again, one more time. Okay, sir, interpret the risk. Slightly. No, it is considerably riskier than the market portfolio. And you would frame it in a well-diversified portfolio. This security is considerably riskier than the market portfolio. In the market portfolio. Now, sir, would you like to make any comment on another number that might agree with or disagree with that assessment of the risk of this stock?
PE ratio is under 30.
It's in, and as such, what is it indicating? And in a more general sense, it's indicating that it is not as risky as the beta is indicating. You will always go with the beta first and foremost, but cover your ass. There is another number there that's telling us that this is not as risky as it seems. The market is unwilling to pay a lot of money betting that a dollar would turn into a bunch of more dollars. Do you see that? The market is saying, okay, a dollar of current earnings belonging to the shareholders is going to generate, we expect, about $22 in change in future earnings that belong to the shareholders. That's why we're paying the price we're paying. But that is not nearly as much as you would see with other securities. We would see securities with betas that are higher. In this case, too. Okay, now, moving on. This is FedEx. FedEx is actually, interestingly, notice that it is, I mean, the earnings per share is ridiculously large. That's $10.86 per share in earnings. That's the money that belongs to the shareholders. That's the residual claim. That's the money that was given. That's the money that belongs to the shareholders. Now, interestingly enough, forward dividend here, their dividend policy is to pay dividends, and that would indicate that the company is using at least some of its money to return to the shareholders instead of reinvesting in the company's growth. Now, another one. Now, these are, of course, OBV. And I'll take this one to you, sir. Comment on the OBV versus average. And you're looking at... Can you do it, or would you like me to pass to someone else? On balance volume. And comment on it. What was the market's... How was the OBV relative to average for the current day?
I think average value is the stuff that's...
No, you're looking at it wrong. I want you to tell me this was a slow day. You see how the average volume is... Yeah, it's a slow day. The average volume is about twice as much as it was today. Okay, so that's quick, and of course that doesn't mean that the overall volume. Remember, I told you about the dark markets where there's a lot of trading that's going on that's off book, which means that the volume figure you see there, which comes from accounting in the ledger of the limit order book, is most likely not the entirety of the activity in the security. So all we can see is what we can see. Those numbers are what they are. But as far as those numbers are concerned, the market, the trading activity in this stock was slow today. Okay? That's, yeah.
So would the answer be slow?
You would want to do it a little bit more complete than that. The trading activity in FedEx common stock was slow relative to the average trading volume in it.
And then if it was above average?
You would say it was a highly active day in this stock. If it was right near it, you'd say it's a relatively average day. Yeah. Oh, you're asking philosophical questions there. It's volume is telling you a very short-term story. And in that way, high activity tends to indicate in an extremely short-term way risk of a security. When there is a very slow, quiet, or average day, I mean, it's just like when you're walking around on campus. If it's, you're not worried. There's no risk other than what you would already have understood. But if you're on campus and there are people running around by the thousands screaming and gnashing their teeth and kicking the squirrels around, then that probably tells you that on a short-term basis, something is going wrong. And if I don't know what it is, that's risk. Ignorance is risk, pure and simple. We don't reward for ignorance you can correct, fix. But if it's ignorance that is pervasive, no one knows why, that's risk in a very short term. Like you'll see volume spikes. What the heck was that all about? That means that for a very short period of time, there was considerably more risk. And in a market like that, I stay away. Okay, this is crazy. I don't understand what's going on. I'm going to step back until the smoke clears and the dust settles. Excellent question. Okay. Yeah.
At what point, relative to market cap, risky?
There's nothing about that. Nothing about that at all. That just tells you that this company, in this case, FedEx, the market, is assessing that the equity value is $64.813 billion. Yeah.
So, in reference to the P/E ratio,
yes.
How can you determine which number is
appropriate? Beta always.
So, 1.57 is quite risky. Now, what number would it be
I'd say that that is telling me a story very different. And when I have a dominant measure, but I also have another measure, and the dominant measure just keeps on saying the same thing over and over again, but the subordinate measure, the secondary measure, keeps signaling a more and more different story, I begin to worry. Like as you said, if this thing sank to 15, and then sank to 10, and then sank to 8, I'd say something is really, really weird going on here. And weird is not what I go with. You know me. I'm a very, very conservative person. I mean, weird scares. And if you have two things that are way away from each other, I mean, even though I believe beta, I will work with it. I don't want to ignore a signal that is saying something very, very different. It's sort of like you're flying on a beautiful big airplane. And, I mean, everything's wonderful. You look out, the wings are smooth and clean, and everything looks great. But you keep looking back, and you see this little puff of smoke. And I mean, all the engines aren't smoking, and the pilot's calm. But you keep looking back there, and that smoke gets bigger and bigger and bigger. When do you stop ignoring it? Stewardess, when do you grab your bags and see if there's a parachute you can leave on? Okay. At some point, that secondary measure, if it gets way out, way away, I get scared about something's going wrong. Why is the market pricing this so low? Go.
Is that PE ratio appropriate for the amount of risk?
Oh, that PE ratio is low. That in this case, if I were writing this in an essay, I would say the PE ratio is indicating considerably lower risk than the beta is indicating. That's how I would frame it. Something like that. Just so that you show me that you, first of all, understand beta, that it is the risk of a stock relative to the market portfolio, and also that there are other measures, among them PE ratio. And in this case, there is a somewhat different story being told by it. Does that mean that I throw beta out the window? No, it's the dominant measure. It's sort of like conspiracy theories. For the most part, they are crazy. But you hear them anyway. Not that I'm a conspiracy theorist, mind you. Okay, I am. Now, I think that's pretty good on that. Give you a good sense. So, yo.
What factors contribute to that difference?
In this case, I would say that the market is not putting a very strong price on this relative to what it probably is indicating that it should be. Let's look at the projection, 241.94. This stock is projected to decline over the next year. That would explain why you've got people aren't wanting to pay for this stock. That's the PE ratio. And why it's risky right now, that's the beta. That's what I see this telling me. This really is a risky stock. Even in a well-diversified portfolio, this is a risky stock. That's an excellent question. And right now, I'm seeing this as a company that the market doesn't particularly favor. That it's going to go up, but then it's going to go back down again. Okay. Now, let me take you to a bond screen. Because I'm going to ask you to interpret a bond screen. Really? I want it to stop doing that. It's giving me corporate bonds. I'm looking for the morning star. Come on. FINRA thinks it's the end all be all. Ah. Let me dump this. I'm going to do New York Times. There we go. Now I'm going to give you a screen from a bond quotation service like this. It will not be the New York Times. However, this is a good one to use. And this is just a, I'm going to give you, it'll be a picture of a bunch of bonds. I'm going to ask you to find a specific bond in there. As a matter of fact, the one I'll have you find, there are two in the screen, which is kind of weird. But I'm going to ask you to characterize the bond first. That means you are going to tell me the term and the investment quality. Now, good investment quality, what do we call a bond that is safe, relatively speaking? It's good. You remember what we call a bond like that? No, but if you hum a few bars, maybe I'll pick up on the chorus. Do you remember what you call it if it's a good, safe, quality bond? You don't remember that? You? It's called an investment-grade bond. You do remember that, right? And if it is a bond that is bad bond, a risky bond, do you remember what I call it, what we call that, sir? You don't. You got anything? Yeah? Oh, don't say that word. Yes, it's called a junk bond, but there's another term that we would use instead of junk. Say it. That is a good term, but there's another, that's acceptable. But there's another term too. Huh? No. High yield. So you have to be a little careful in this world, because you could have an investment advisor say, I've got some high yield bonds that you should invest in. That is a way to describe a very bad sandwich as being delicious. Okay? Have you ever had food that you were told this is very high end, this is very good quality, this is the best thing you can eat all day? And what they're doing is they're seeing if you're a sucker and you'll eat what they say is a high quality international favorite. And in fact, it sucks real bad. Okay, it's sort of like, have you ever eaten snails, escargot? No, don't. I don't care if they call them gourmet. They're not. They're slimy creatures. I went to a Japanese restaurant. They had a jumping salad. I was just not going to be a really international person unless I ate it. You know why they call it a jumping salad? Because there are a bunch of little shrimp in it still jumping around, and you eat them that way? Yeah. No. You just get me down to Burger King. I'll get me a Whopper. You go ahead and eat those things that are squirming around. Anyway, see, you got to watch it. High yield sounds good. That's an indication that the bond is dangerous. It's risky. That doesn't mean you shouldn't invest in it, but that means that you should be a risk taker and you should go in eyes wide open. Here, now the one I'll give you doesn't have all three of the rating services. It has just two of them. But that's enough for you to determine its investment quality. Is this an investment grade security, or is this a high yield, non-investment grade security? So in terms of, if I ask you to characterize the debt instrument, I am clearly asking you to tell me the term of the security. I'm also asking you to tell me about its investment quality and what its coupon is. At a minimum. Then I will go on, and that's pretty easy to do. Then I will go on, and you should answer in the second sentence, to tell me why the bond is selling at a premium or a discount to par. In this case, look at CVS. Look at CVS. Now, as far as CVS is concerned, sir, is that bond selling at a premium or a discount to par? Oh, no, man. What's the price of it? Quote it. Quote CVS. No. Okay, give me some breathing room here. Quote CVS. No, don't say that. That's not. Oh, no. It's $1,020. Quote. The quote is $102,323. Now, is it selling at a discount or a premium to par?
Selling at a discount.
No, come on. Is it above 100 or below 100? So it's premium, okay? It's premium. So it's selling at a premium to par. So I need you to be able to come at me as fast as you can. Okay, I'm looking at Citigroup. Citigroup is selling at a significant premium to par at 106.53. Now, going back to CVS, why is CVS selling at a premium to par? Tell me why. Can you?
The yield percent is lower than the coupon.
Don't say the percent. Yield is below coupon. Yield is below coupon. Therefore, the market thinks that the coupon is higher than it needs to be. And so investors will be attracted to this. Demand will go up, price will go up. But what you need to say is the reason it is selling at a premium to par is that the yield is below the coupon. That's how you answer. Yes. Yeah, it's above 100. It's selling at a premium, and the yield is, you're talking about general?
Yeah, but it's right at 100. So.
No, it's not right at. It's a slightly above. Look at the date of maturity. Do you see that this thing has only about 9 months left on its life?
Yeah.
All bonds, and this is something that I'll teach you in the next half of the course, the farther away a bond is from its maturity date, the more any difference is magnified in price deviation from par. Every bond, the day it matures, pays its holders $1,000. So no matter how much the spread is between yield and coupon, as a bond approaches its maturity date, it's going to pay $1,000. So the price will converge from above or below on $1,000. As you get closer to the maturity date. So in this case, yeah, the yield is considerably below the coupon. So it should sell at a premium to par, but it's not selling at much of a premium to par because it's so close to maturing. I mean, you're not going to get anything out of that difference. You're going to get $1,000 in 9 months. That's a good question, though, and that's something that I'll cover in the next part of the course, is that, yeah, go ahead.
Should I look to the last price of it to determine?
Okay, look at Walgreens. The yield, what the market says it should pay, is 4.89%.
Yeah.
It is paying only 4.8%. Therefore, it will sell at a discount to par because it's not paying as much as the market said it should pay more than it's paying. The market's saying that it should pay 4.89%. It's paying only 4.8%. So it is going to be, the market's going to punish the bond. Now, notice that that's a large, because that Walgreens bond still has a long life left on it. That even that small difference between yield and coupon is going to magnify into a significant deviation from par. But yeah, in this case, market says you should be paying 4.89%. You are paying only 4.80%, so we're going to smack you for that. We're going to drop the price below par. And we're going to drop it a lot because there's a lot of time left for that difference to make trouble for us. Follow that?
Yep.
Okay, next thing. Let me take you through that's three of the questions. I mean, that's three of your four questions right there. I mean, you couldn't ask for any more. That's why they call me Pizza Hut. I deliver. Now I'm going to give you about seven or eight possibilities for the fourth one. It's more of a open from lectures. Now remember, these answers, these problems are from my lectures. It might also be in the book, but it is not necessarily in the book. So you have to have been in the lectures, taken good notes, or listened to the podcasts, and follow on what I've talked about there. These are the big things that will be helpful to you. Much more so than studying and finding study buddies and all of that, because you got to watch out for that, because you're going to be misled by some. The ones who are the loudest are most likely the ones who know the least. If someone really knows the answers, that's a person who's probably not going to be sharing them with anyone. So be careful about groupthink and about the internet. It's a very dangerous place. Oh, while I'm remembering it, I've already mentioned this. I know I have. But I do live casts and postings on Twitter on my hashtag ProfSee, where I give you updates on how I'm doing on the exams. You'll see pictures of me grading and Phineas walking around trying to figure out what I'm doing, and my other two cats, Gabriel and Matilda, walking around. And once in a while, you'll see me drinking something that looks like coffee that might not be, as I get into some really weird answers. But you can follow me there if you want. But anyway, okay. Taking this down. I could ask you a question about flight to quality. Explain flight to quality. Now remember, you have two sentences. Read that rubric. Don't waste time at all on trying to set up your answer. Get it out. Don't ever, ever start a business communication with I think, I feel, or I believe. We don't care about your thoughts, feelings, and beliefs. We're capitalists. Okay, the next thing is another one. What is the relationship between risk and return? Now, you have to be careful with me. I might say the word return, but unless you put a word in front of that, you're going to lose points. It has that whole thing to do with the future. You can't tell me a return. And you can't promise me a formula or a theory that would give you the return. It can give you something return, but not just return. Remember that. Starts with an E, that adjective. Okay. Another one. What is money and what are the four types? What is money and what are the four types? This will be the first time I say four if I ask it. Up to this point, it's always been three, but now we've got to confront that fourth one. Okay, now another one. Explain liquidity. And address the trade-off between liquidity of a security and expected return. Again, explain liquidity and address the trade-off, or I'm sorry, the relationship between the liquidity of a security and its expected return. The liquidity of a security and its expected return. Who has the prior claim and who has the residual claim to the cash flows of a corporation? Who has the prior claim and who has the residual claim to the cash flows of a corporation? As the second part of that question, what does this imply about the relative expected returns? To these two classes of investors. What does this imply about the relative expected returns to these two classes of investors? Your turn. Yes. You want, that one again. Okay. Who has the prior claim and who has the residual claim to the cash flows of a corporation? And what does this imply about the relative expected returns to these two classes of investors? Did I mention the flight to quality one? Okay. It's your turn. Ask me questions. Yes. Oh, yes, you get a 4x6. And don't ask me front and back. I'm not going to walk around trying to check to see if you got front and back. I recommend that you write neatly enough. I've had students ask me what they wrote. Can you read? Here's the one. It's genius until it's not. Student who writes all these notes on an 8, types them up on an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper, then photo reduces it down to 4x6. And then can't read a damn thing on it. So don't go that far, okay? Yeah. Yeah, I can't go and see if you're not. Yeah, so front and back. It was 2 years ago, I had a student who had written crib notes on his arm. He hadn't been in class enough to even know that they could have a note card. I hope he got ballpoint pen poisoning. Yes. Go.
So besides the first one that we went over, just for that fourth question, we can answer everything expecting that you just ask those five questions and we'll be covered on the exam.
Five questions?
You gave us like five.
I gave him six. Yeah. I'm going to ask only one of them.
What?
Only one of them am I going to ask.
Right, so if we know the answers to all the six that you just went through.
Oh, I see what you're at. Oh,
yeah.
I mean, it's not going to be verbatim, but it'll be that question, yes.
Okay.
I have, by the way, office hours tomorrow from noon until 3. And also on Wednesday, I'll be in my office from 1 until class time about 3:15. And don't come in and ask me, can you pre-grade this answer? I'm not going to do that. But we will sit down. I can answer more broadly questions and challenge you. Go. Tomorrow? On Wednesday? I'll be there from 1 till 3, about 3:15, because I have to have a little time before my first class to get the exams and all that. Which reminds me, I could put the exam up on the overhead now if you want to see it. Okay. Just wanted to see if anyone was still listening. Okay. That's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.